of his own wife, in a classic KGB dangle. "You enjoyed London, didn't you?" he said. Layla agreed that their life in Britain had been magical. She already missed the Middle Eastern cafes on Edgware Road, the parks and the music. He pressed on. "You know how you said you wanted the girls to go to English schools?" Layla nodded, wondering where this was going. "I have enemies here. We are never going to be sent back to London. But I have an idea. We could go to Azerbaijan on holiday to visit your family there, and then slip over the mountains into Turkey. We could escape and go back to Britain. What do you think, Layla? Shall we run away?" There was a narrow, heavily militarized 11-mile border between Azerbaijan and Turkey. Gordievsky, of course, had no real intention of trying to get across it. This was a test. I wanted to gauge her reaction to the idea. If she agreed, it would be a sign that she was willing, at some level, to defy Soviet law and run away with him. He could then introduce her to the Pimlico plan and reveal the real reason he needed to escape. If she refused and was interrogated after his disappearance, she might provide a false clue about his escape route and send the hunters herring to the Azeri-Turkish border. Layla looked at him as if he was raving. "Don't be idiotic." He quickly dropped the subject, and deep inside him a dreadful conviction took root. "My heart was aching so much that I could hardly bear to think about it. His wife's loyalty could not be relied upon, and he must continue to deceive her." That conclusion may have been wrong. Many years later, Layla was asked whether, if she had known of the escape plan, she would have told the authorities. "I would have let him escape," she said. "Oleg had made his moral choice, and for that, at least, he deserves respect. Whether considered bad or good, the man made his choice in life. He did it because he considered it necessary. Knowing the mortal danger he was in, my soul could not have carried the sin of sending him to his death." She did not, however, say whether she would have been prepared to join him in the escape attempt. Still on the balcony, he told her again, "There is a conspiracy. People are very jealous of my appointment as resident. But if something happens to me, don't believe anything anyone tells you. I'm a proud officer, a Russian officer, and I did nothing wrong." She believed him. Gordievsky was not given to introspection, but at night, with Layla sleeping peacefully alongside him, he wondered what kind of person he had become, and whether his double life had drastically inhibited his emotional development. He had never told Layla who he really was. Inevitably, this meant that we had never come as close as we might have in normal circumstances. Always I had withheld the central feature of my existence from her. Is intellectual deception of one's partner more or less cruel than physical deception? Who can say? But his mind was made up. My overriding priority was to save my skin. He would attempt to escape alone. At least that way, he reflected, Layla would be able to tell the KGB honestly that she had known nothing. The decision to leave his family behind was either an act of monumental self-sacrifice or one of selfish self-preservation, or both. He told himself he had no choice, which is what we all tell ourselves when forced to make a terrible choice. Layla's father, the elderly KGB general, had a dacha in Azerbaijan on the shores of Lake Caspian, where Layla had spent her childhood holidays. It was agreed that she and the girls would join her Azeri family there for a long summer holiday. Masha and Anna were excited at the prospect of spending a month at their grandfather's dacha, swimming and playing in the sun. Gordievsky's parting from his family was an agony, not least because Layla and the girls had no inkling of its significance. The saddest moment of his life took place in a humdrum rush, in a bustling supermarket doorway. Layla was distracted, rushing to buy clothes and other last-minute supplies for the train journey south. The girls had already vanished into the shop before he could embrace them. Layla gave him a swift kiss on the cheek and a cheerful wave. "That could have been a bit more tender," he said, half to himself, the reproach of a man about to commit an act of desertion that would end in indefinite separation at best, and at worst, his own arrest, disgrace, and execution. Layla did not hear him. She vanished into the crowded shop in pursuit of their daughters without a backward glance, and part of his heart broke. On Sunday, June 30th, after 3 hours of dry cleaning, exhausted and rigid with tension, Gordievsky arrived at Red Square, which was packed with Russian tourists. At the Lenin Museum, he headed to the basement lavatories, locked himself in a cubicle, and took a pen and envelope out of his pocket. Opening up the envelope, hands quivering, he wrote in block capitals, "Am under strong suspicion and in bad trouble, need exfiltration soonest, beware of radioactive dust and car accidents." Gordievsky suspected he had been sprayed with spy dust. He knew the KGB had a nasty technique of ramming cars that might be involved in an espionage operation to force the actors into the open. As a last act of evasion, he entered GUM, the vast department store running along the side of Red Square, and moved swiftly from one department to another, up and down stairs, along one aisle and down another. Anyone observing him would have assumed he was an overexcited but hopelessly indecisive shopper, or that he was trying to shake off a tail. It was only now that he spotted a flaw in the brush contact plan. He was supposed to be recognized by his cap, but men were not allowed to wear hats in St. Basil's. Religion was banned in communist Russia, but marks of religious respect, oddly, were still observed. That hiccup paled to irrelevance a moment later, when he entered the vast cathedral a few minutes before 3 p.m., headed for the stairs, and found the way barred by a large sign, "Upper floors, closed for redecoration." The staircase, on which he was supposed to pass his message, was sealed off with tape. Stumped, his shirt soaked with the sweat of adrenaline and fear, he looked around, pretending to admire the cathedral interior, wondering if the lady in grey might still be lingering. There was no one fitting that description among the crowds. People seemed to be staring back at him. On the metro, he carefully tore the envelope to pieces inside his pocket, chewed each fragment to pulp, and spat them out, one by one. Close to despair, he arrived home 3 hours after he had left, wondering when or even if the KGB surveillance team had lost and found him again. The brush contact had failed. The MI6 team in Moscow had not picked up the signal flown at the Central Market on June 15th. The reason was simple. MI6 already knew that the top floor of St. Basil's was closed for renovation. We had to work on the assumption that before flying the Central Market signal, it would have checked the St. Basil's location and realized this was a non-starter. Many years later, Ascot looked back on the missed signal as a blessing. Thank God. Red Square was a terrible place for a brush contact, stuffed with KGB. I tried to ban that meeting place. We would have been caught. The KGB waited and watched. In London, MI6 tried to imagine what had happened to their spy, hope ebbing. MI6 continued to monitor the escape signal site. Every evening at 7:30, Ascot, G, or the secretary, Violet, headed to the pavement outside the bread shop, sometimes by car. The signal time had been chosen to coincide with a convenient moment when they would normally be returning from work, or on foot. They were buying far more bread than they could eat. It was agreed that if one of them spotted the man with the Safeway bag, he or she would call Ascot and leave a message about tennis. That would be the signal between them that Pimlico was underway. And on the other side of the city, Gordievsky wondered how his life had come to this. An enemy of the people, about to desert his family, drinking too much and guzzling prescription sedatives, trying to summon up the courage to activate a plan that was probably suicidal. He paid another visit to Mikhail Lyubimov, who was struck once more by the change in Gordievsky's behavior. He looked even worse than before, nervously pulled out of his briefcase an open bottle of Export Stolichnaya and poured himself a drink with a shaking hand. Lyubimov, touched and saddened, invited him to come and stay at his dacha in Zvenigorod. "We can chat and relax." Lyubimov came away thinking that his old friend might be close to suicide. Back at the flat, questions ricocheted around Gordievsky's exhausted, pickled mind. Why had the brush contact failed? Had MI6 abandoned him? Why was the KGB still toying with him? Who had betrayed him? Could he get away? William Shakespeare has an answer for most of life's questions. In Hamlet, the greatest writer in the English language pondered the nature of fate and courage, when life's challenges seem overwhelming. When sorrows come, they come not single spies, but in battalions. On Monday, July 15th, 1985, Oleg Gordievsky reached for his copy of Shakespeare's sonnets. He had left a pile of clothes to soak in the kitchen sink, and now deftly slipped the book under them and into the soapy water. After 10 minutes, the book was sodden. The only place in the flat he could be sure of being unseen by any hidden cameras was a small box room off the corridor. Inside, by the light of a candle, Gordievsky peeled back the wet endpaper, extracted the thin cellophane sheet inside, and read the escape instructions. The train from Paris to Marseille. The distances and kilometer post 836. If he flew the signal the next day, Tuesday, and it was acknowledged, he could be picked up on Saturday. The very familiarity of the instructions was reassuring. He dropped the soaked copy of the sonnets down the rubbish chute. That night he slept with the instructions in a tin tray on the bedside table, under a newspaper, with a box of matches alongside. If the KGB raided in the night, he would probably have time to destroy the damning evidence. The next morning, Tuesday, July 16th, he read the escape plan for the last time in the dark box room, and then watched the cellophane sheet flare up with an acrid flash. The telephone rang. It was Leila's father, Ali Aliyev, the retired KGB general. The old man knew that his son-in-law was having problems at work, and had been asked by his daughter to look after Gordievsky while the family was away at the dacha. "Come for supper at 7 tonight," said Aliyev. "I'll cook a nice chicken and garlic." Gordievsky thought fast. The invitation for 7 p.m. clashed with the escape signal timing. The KGB eavesdroppers listening in on the bug telephone would be suspicious if he turned it down. And if he accepted, they would be expecting him at his father-in-law's home at Davidkova, on the city outskirts, at the very moment when, with luck, he would be free of surveillance at the signal site on Kutuzovsky Prospect. "Thank you," he said. "I'll look forward to it." Gordievsky wanted to look smart for his rendezvous with MI6, even if the KGB was waiting. He dressed in suit and tie, put on shoes that were probably radioactive, and picked up his Danish leather cap. Then he took the Safeway plastic bag with its distinctive bright red logo from the drawer of his desk. The phone rang again. It was Mikhail Yubimov, urging him to come and stay at his dacha for a few days the following week. Gordievsky, again thinking quickly, accepted the invitation. He would come on Monday, he said, catch the train arriving at Zvenigorod at 11:13, and travel in the last carriage. On the notebook by his telephone he wrote, "Zvenigorod, 11:13. Here was another false trail for the KGB. By the following Monday, he would be either in prison or in Britain, or dead. At 4 p.m. he left the flat, and for the next 2 hours and 45 minutes carried out the most rigorous dry-cleaning operation so far. Shops, buses, metro stations, in and out of apartment blocks, pausing to buy some provisions to bulk up the Safeway bag, methodically brushing off his tail and moving just fast and erratically enough to make it all but impossible to keep up with him, but not so swift as to make that obvious. Only the most skilled trackers could have followed him through this artificial maze. At 6:45, he emerged from Kievsky metro station. He could not detect anyone following him. He had gone black, or so he fervently hoped. Tuesday, July 16th, was a glorious summer evening, clear and bright. He walked slowly toward the bread shop, and killed time by buying a packet of cigarettes. 10 minutes early for the 7:30 signal, he took up the position on the edge of the sidewalk, outside the bread shop. The heavy traffic on the avenue included numerous official limousines, carrying home members of the Politburo and KGB officials. He lit a cigarette. The edge of the sidewalk suddenly seemed an idiotically conspicuous place to stand. There were too many people milling about, reading the notice boards and bus timetables, or pretending to. The place seemed suspiciously crowded. A black Volga, a favored vehicle of the KGB, pulled out of the traffic and mounted the sidewalk. Two men in dark suits jumped out. He flinched. The driver seemed to be staring at him. The two men entered the shops and re-emerged with a strongbox, a routine cash collection. He tried to breathe again. He lit another cigarette. It was Arthur G's turn to monitor the signal site, but the traffic was slow. Roy and Caroline Ascott were going out to dinner with a Russian acquaintance, a former diplomat. As they pulled on to Kutuzovsky Prospect in their Saab and headed east, a surveillance car slotted in behind as usual. It was easy to spot the KGB vehicles, the brushes of the KGB car wash, for reasons unknown, could not quite reach a spot in the middle of the hood, so each car had a telltale triangle of dirt on the front. Ascot glanced across the wide avenue and froze. A man was standing in front of the bread shop, holding a carrier bag with a distinctive red pattern, like a beacon among the drab Soviet shopping bags. The time was 7:40. Gordievsky's instructions were to remain at the site no longer than half an hour. Arthur's missed him, thought Ascot, swearing under his breath. My heart went straight to my toes. He poked Caroline in the ribs, pointed across the road, and drew on the dashboard the shape of the letter P for Pimlico. Caroline resisted the urge to swivel in her seat and stare. I knew exactly what he meant. Ascot had 10 seconds to decide if he should swing the car around and perform the recognition signal. There were Kit Kat bars in the glove compartment, but the KGB was already tight on his bumper, and any change of behavior would instantly arouse suspicion. The KGB would know, from bugging the telephone, that they were going out to dinner. Suddenly performing a U-turn, jumping out of the car and eating a chocolate bar while walking down the sidewalk would lead the KGB straight to Pimlico. I drove on, feeling as if the world had fallen in and I had done the wrong thing for the right reasons. The dinner party was hellish. Their host was an unreconstructed communist apparatchik who spent the whole evening talking about how great Stalin was. All Ascot could think about was the spy with the Safeway bag, waiting in vain for a man with a chocolate bar. In fact, while Ascot had been driving east on Kutuzovsky, Arthur G. passed the bread shop in his Ford Sierra, slowed a little, and scanned the sidewalk. There seemed to be lots of people milling around, noticeably more than usual for a weekday evening. And there, on the edge of the sidewalk, he was almost certain, was a man wearing a peaked cap holding an unusual shopping bag. Whether it was adorned with a large red S, he could not be quite sure. G drove on, adrenaline racing, made a U-turn at the end of the avenue, entered the compound and parked in the garage. Trying to appear unhurried, he took the elevator to the flat, dropped his briefcase, and called loudly to Rachel, "I need to get some bread." She immediately knew what was happening. We had absolutely tons of bread already. G swiftly changed into his grey trousers, picked up the Harrods bag, and grabbed a Mars bar from the kitchen drawer. The time was 7:45. The elevator took an eternity. He walked to the underpass, fighting the urge to run. The man had gone. He wondered if he would recognize him anyway, since he had only ever seen one grainy photograph of Pimlico standing outside a butcher's shop in a Danish suburb. I was so convinced I had seen someone, G recalled. He queued at the bread shop, keeping one eye on the street, which seemed even more crowded than before. G decided to make another pass, one hand on the Harrods bag in his pocket. Then he saw him. A man of medium height, holding a Safeway bag, standing in the shadow of a shop. He was smoking a cigarette. For a moment, G hesitated. Veronica had never described Pimlico as a smoker, and it was not the sort of detail she would have omitted. Gordievsky spotted G at the same moment. On the point of leaving, he had drawn back from the sidewalk edge. It was not the man's grey trousers that first caught his attention, or the way he drew a green bag from his pocket, took out a bar of chocolate, and tore off the black wrapper. It was his demeanor. To Gordievsky's famished eyes, the man walking toward him, chewing, looked wholly, unmistakably British. Their eyes locked for less than a second. Gordievsky heard himself silently shouting at the top of his voice, "Yes, it's me." G took another deliberate bite of the Mars bar, slowly looked away, and walked on. Both men knew with crystal conviction that the signal had been flown and it had been acknowledged. General Aliyev was annoyed when Gordievsky finally arrived at his flat, sweaty and apologetic, nearly 2 hours late. His special garlic chicken was overcooked, yet his son-in-law seemed strangely elated and devoured the burned meal with gusto. Roy and Caroline Ascot returned from their excruciating dinner party around midnight, accompanied by 5 surveillance cars. Beside the telephone was a note from the nanny, saying that Arthur G. had called and left a message. The German tennis player, Boris Becker, had won Wimbledon for the first time, at the age of 17. The message read, "Would you like to come and watch a video of the tennis later in the week. Grinning, Ascot showed the message to his wife. She had picked up the escape signal after all. I was relieved that he'd seen it, but it was like the coming of Armageddon. Pimlico had been triggered. The KGB surveillance team had already lost Gordievsky twice. On both occasions, he soon popped up again, but he knew that they would be more attentive from now on, if they were any good at their jobs, which, oddly, they were not. The decision to use a surveillance team from within the first chief directorate, rather than the experienced professionals of the seventh directorate, had been taken for reasons of internal office politics. Viktor Grushko did not want the story of Gordievsky's treachery gaining wider currency. The deputy head of the FCD was determined to solve this embarrassing and possibly damaging problem in-house. But the team allocated to follow the suspect were used to trailing around after Chinese diplomats, a boring job requiring little imagination or expertise. They did not know who Gordievsky was or what he had done. They had no idea they were tailing a trained spy and dangerous traitor. And so, when Gordievsky lost them, they assumed it was accidental. Admitting to failure was not a career-enhancing move in the KGB, so instead of reporting that their quarry had vanished, twice, they were merely relieved when he turned up again, and kept their mouths shut. On Wednesday morning, July 17th, Gordievsky left the flat and headed, using every trick in the anti-surveillance manual, toward Leningrad Station on Komsomolskaya Square to buy a train ticket. At the bank, he took out 300 rubles in cash, wondering if the KGB was monitoring his account. He trailed through a shopping center, and then headed for a nearby housing project where a narrow footpath passed between high apartment buildings, arranged in two blocks of three. He turned the corner at the end of the path, and sprinted 30 yards into the nearest staircase and up one flight. From the landing window, he saw an overweight man in a jacket and tie burst into view at a fast jog, and then stop and look up and down the pathway, clearly flustered. Gordievsky shrank into the shadow. The man spoke into a lapel microphone and ran on. A moment later, a beige Lada, another vehicle favored by the KGB, came rattling up the footpath at a brisk pace. The man and woman in the front seat were both speaking into a microphone. Gordievsky choked down a fresh squall of terror. He had known the KGB was tailing him, but this was the first time he had flushed them out into the open. They were probably following the classic KGB surveillance pattern. One car out front, two others nearby in support, two officers in each, linked by radio, one to follow on foot whenever necessary, the other by road. He waited 5 minutes, then descended, walked briskly to the main road, caught a bus, then a taxi, then a metro train, and finally reached Leningrad Station. There, under a false name, he booked a fourth-class ticket for the 5:30 p.m. overnight train to Leningrad, leaving on Friday, July 19th, and paid in cash. When he got home, he spotted the beige Lada, parked a little way down the street. Simon Brown was on leave. Gordievsky's case officer was still coming to terms with the grim situation. One of the most effective agents ever recruited by British intelligence had been sent back to Moscow, and apparently straight into a KGB ambush. Inevitably, questions were being asked. How had Gordievsky been found out? Was there another mole inside MI6? The familiar leaden fear of internal betrayal gnawed once more. As for Gordievsky, he was now surely languishing in a KGB cell, if he was not already dead. The relationship between an agent and case officer is a peculiar amalgam of the professional and the emotional. A good agent runner provides psychological stability, financial support, encouragement, hope, and a strange species of love, but also the promise of protection. Recruiting and running a spy carries a duty of care, the implicit commitment that the spy's safety will always come first, and the risks will not outweigh the rewards. Every case officer feels the burden of that pact, and Brown, a sensitive man, felt it more acutely than most. He had done everything right, but the case had gone wrong, and the responsibility was ultimately his. Brown tried not to dwell on what Gordievsky must be going through, but could think of little else. Losing an agent can feel like an act of intimate betrayal. P5, the head of the Soviet operational section, was in his Century House office at 7:30 a.m. on Wednesday, July 17th, when the phone rang. A double encrypted telegram had been sent overnight by the Moscow office, hidden among the regular flow of Foreign Office wireless traffic. It read, "Pimlico flown. Heavy SV surveillance. Exfiltration underway. Advise." P5 dashed downstairs to C's office. Christopher Cohen had been fully briefed on the case, but seemed momentarily phased. "Do we have a plan?" he said. "Yes, sir," said P5. "We do." Brown was in the garden trying to distract himself by reading a book in the sunshine when the call came through from P5. "I think it would be useful if you popped in." The voice was neutral. A minute after he put the telephone down, Brown clicked. It was Wednesday. That meant something had happened on the Tuesday. It must be the escape signal. Hope suddenly leaped. Gordievsky might still be alive. The train from Guildford to London seemed to take forever. Brown arrived on the 12th floor to find the team in a scramble of feverish preparations. Suddenly it was non-stop, Brown recalled. After a series of hurried meetings, Martin Shawford flew to Copenhagen to alert the Danish intelligence service and coordinate plans, before flying on to Helsinki to prepare the groundwork, contact the MI6 station there, hire vehicles, and reconnoiter the rendezvous point near the Finnish border. Assuming Gordievsky and his family were successfully smuggled across the Russian border, a second phase of the escape plan would begin, because reaching Finland would not mean that Gordievsky was safe. As Ascot observed, the Finns had an agreement with the Russians to turn over to the KGB any fugitives from the Soviet Union that fell into their hands. The term Finlandization had come to mean any small state, cowed into submission by a much more powerful neighbor, retaining theoretical sovereignty, but effectively in thrall. Finland was officially neutral in the Cold War, but the Soviet Union retained many of the conditions of control in the country. Finland could not join NATO or allow Western troops or weapon systems on its territory. Anti-Soviet books and films were banned. The Finns deeply resented the term Finlandization, but it accurately represented the situation of a country forced to look both ways, keen to be seen as Western, but unwilling and unable to alienate the Soviet Union. The Finnish cartoonist Kari Suomalainen once described his country's uncomfortable position as the art of bowing to the East without mooning the West. A few months before, the MI6 Sovblock controller had paid a visit to Finland to meet up with Seppo Titinen, the chief of the Finnish Security Intelligence Service, known as Supo. The MI6 visitor posed a hypothetical question. "If we had a defector that we needed to bring through Finland, I imagine that you would rather we got him out without involving you." Titinen replied, "Quite right. Tell us about it afterward." The Finns did not want to know anything in advance, and if Gordievsky was intercepted in Finland by the Finnish authorities, he would almost certainly be returned to the Soviet Union. If he was not, and the Soviets discovered he was there, the Finns would come under intense pressure to seize him, and if they did not, the KGB was perfectly capable of sending a Spetsnaz Special Forces squad to do the job. The Soviets were known to monitor Finnish airports, so simply flying the family out of Helsinki was not an option. Instead, two cars would transport the escapees 800 miles to the far north of Finland. One car would be driven by Veronica and Simon, the other by two Danish intelligence officers, Jens Eriksen, the officer known as Asterix, who had worked with Richard Bromhead a decade earlier, and his partner, Bjørn Larsen. Southeast of Tromsø, at the remote Karigajniemi border crossing, they would enter Norway and NATO territory. The team debated whether to deploy a military C-130 Hercules to pick them up, but instead decided that a scheduled flight from Norway would attract less attention. From Hammerfest, the northernmost city in Europe, inside the Arctic Circle, they would be flown to Oslo and connect with another commercial flight to London. The Danes had been integral to the case from the start, and the two PET officers would drive the other escape car and accompany the exfiltration team all the way to Hammerfest. It was partly courtesy, but we also might need Danish cover to get into Norway. Local Scandinavian help in case we hit some snag. Veronica Price retrieved the shoebox marked Pimlico, containing four false Danish passports for Gordievsky and his family, in the name of Hansen. She packed mosquito repellent, clean clothes, and a shaving kit. Gordievsky would certainly need a shave. She hoped the Moscow team would remember to bring additional spare tires, in good condition, in case of punctures. That, too, was in the escape plan. For nearly 2 months, the Nocton team, now renamed Pimlico, had waited, grim, inactive, and anxious. Now they were excited and suddenly operating at a hectic pace. There was a complete change of tone, Brown recalled. It was a surreal feeling. This was something we'd been practicing for years. Now we were all thinking, my God, we have to do this for real. Will it ever work? In the safe speech room of the British Embassy in Moscow, the personnel of the MI6 station gathered to rehearse an amateur dramatic performance. The trip to Finland, in two diplomatic cars, required a cover story that the listening KGB would believe. To make matters even more complicated, a new British ambassador, Sir Brian Cartledge, would be arriving in Moscow on Thursday, and a drinks reception was to be held in his honor at the embassy the following evening. The two cars needed to be at the rendezvous point south of the Finnish border at exactly 2:30 on Saturday, but KGB suspicions would immediately be raised if Ascot and G, nominally two of Cartledge's senior diplomats, were not present to toast his arrival. They needed a believable emergency. Before leaving home, G had passed his wife a note, written on toilet paper. "You're going to have to get ill," it read. The story would go like this. Rachel G would suddenly develop an extremely painful back. Although a woman of considerable vitality, she had suffered from asthma and other health problems in the past, a fact that would be known to the all-hearing KGB. She and her husband would agree to drive to Helsinki to see a specialist. Caroline Ascot, her close friend, would suggest that she and her husband come too and make a weekend of it. The two couples would drive in two separate cars and agree to do some shopping in the Finnish capital at the same time. The Ascots would bring along their 15-month-old daughter, Florence, leaving their two other children with the nanny. We decided it was better cover if we took the baby. They would attend the ambassador's drinks party on Friday, set off immediately afterward, drive overnight to Leningrad, and then on across the Finnish border to make the doctor's appointment in Helsinki late on Saturday afternoon. The performance started that afternoon, with each of the four actors playing a part. In the flat, Rachel G started complaining, for the hidden KGB microphones, of a searing pain in her lower back. The complaints grew steadily louder as the day wore on. "I gave it the works," she said. Her friend Caroline Ascot came around to see if she could help. "There was a great deal of groaning from me and poor ewing from Caroline," Rachel recalled. Her imitation of a woman in pain was so convincing that her mother-in-law, who happened to be visiting, became alarmed. G took his mother for a walk, away from the microphones, to explain that Rachel was not really unwell at all. "Rachel was a wonderful actress," said Ascot. Arthur G called a doctor friend in Finland, on the bug telephone, to ask for medical advice. He also telephoned a number of airlines to inquire about flights, but rejected these on the grounds of cost. "Why don't we come too?" said Caroline, when Rachel told her she was going to have to drive to Finland. The scene now shifted to the Ascot's flat. When Caroline told her husband that he would be driving overnight to Finland with their baby to take poor Rachel to a doctor and do some shopping, Ascot put on a show of extreme reluctance. "Oh, God, what a bore. Do we really have to? The new ambassador is arriving. I have lots of work to do," before finally agreeing to the trip. Somewhere in the Russian archives is a set of eavesdropping transcripts that together add up to a small, strange melodrama, staged by MI6 entirely for the benefit of the KGB. Ascot and G wondered whether the whole charade was a waste of time, and the escape plan doomed to failure. "Something doesn't smell right," said G. Both had spotted what seemed to be unusually high levels of activity at the signal site on Tuesday evening, with large numbers of cars and milling pedestrians, possibly indicating increased surveillance. If the KGB kept them under close watch all the way to the Finnish border, it would be impossible to slip into the turnout and pick up the escapees without being spotted, and the operation would fail. G was not even sure that the man with the Safeway bag was really Pimlico. Perhaps the KGB had uncovered the escape plan and sent a stand-in, while the real Pimlico was already in custody. Surveillance also seemed heavier around the embassy and diplomatic compound. "My fear was that it was all a setup," said G. "The KGB might be putting on its own performance, drawing MI6 into a trap that would lead to exposure, expulsion of both officers for activities incompatible, and a violent diplomatic explosion that would embarrass the British government and set back Anglo-Soviet relations at a vital moment. Even if we were heading into an ambush, I knew we had no choice but to press ahead anyway. The escape signal had been flown." Ascot still did not know Pimlico's identity, but London now decided to reveal what he was. A KGB colonel, a long-term agent, and a person for whom it was worth taking this monumental risk. "It was a boost to morale," wrote Ascot. The MI6 station kept Century House abreast of preparations, although the number of cables passing between London and Moscow was kept to a minimum, in case the KGB spotted the increased activity and became suspicious. In London, too, there was disquiet within the tiny circle made aware that Pimlico was underway. There were voices saying, "This is too dangerous. If it goes wrong, this will completely upend Anglo-Soviet relations." Several senior Foreign Office mandarins were extremely dubious about the escape plan, including the Foreign Secretary, Geoffrey Howe, and Sir Brian Cartledge, Britain's newly appointed ambassador to Moscow. Cartledge was due to arrive in Russia on Thursday, July 18th. He had been briefed on Pimlico 2 months before, but told it was highly unlikely to be implemented. Now he was informed that MI6 planned, 2 days after his arrival, to smuggle a senior KGB officer out of Russia in the trunk of a car. The exfiltration had been meticulously planned and rehearsed, MI6 explained, but it was also highly risky, and whether or not it succeeded, there would be major diplomatic repercussions. A career diplomat with an academic pedigree, Sir Brian had already served in Sweden, Iran, and Russia, before taking up his first ambassadorial post in Hungary. His appointment as ambassador in Moscow was the high point of his career. He was not happy. "Poor Brian Cartledge," Ascot recalled. "He had just started a new job and he had this smoking bomb handed to him." He saw his last ambassadorship going down the tubes. If the escape team was caught in the act, there was a possibility that the new ambassador might even be declared persona non grata before he had presented his credentials to the Kremlin, a humiliating diplomatic first. The new ambassador registered a strong objection and argued that the operation be called off. A meeting was called at the Foreign Office. Present were the MI6 delegation, consisting of the chief, Christopher Kerwin, his deputy, P5, and the Sov Block controller, and various Foreign Office officials, including Brian Cartledge and David Goodall, the deputy undersecretary. Goodall, according to one of those present, got into a frightful flap and kept repeating, "What are we going to do?" Cartledge was still fuming. "It's an absolute bloody disaster. I've got to leave for Moscow tomorrow, and in a week I'll be back again." The deputy head of MI6 was adamant. "If we don't go ahead with this, the service will never be able to hold its head up again." At this moment, the meeting was joined by Sir Robert Armstrong, the cabinet secretary, who had crossed the road from Downing Street. He loudly plonked his leather briefcase on the table. "I am quite certain that the Prime Minister will feel we have an overwhelming moral duty to save this man." That ended the debate. Sir Brian Cartledge looked like a man going to the gallows as the Foreign Office contingent headed off to inform the Foreign Secretary, who had just returned from a memorial service. Howe remained hesitant. "What if it goes wrong?" he asked. "What if the car is searched?" To his credit, the new ambassador now spoke up. "We'll say it's a gross provocation. We'll say they shoved the fellow in the boot of the car." "Hmm," said Howe dubiously. "I suppose so." Operation Pimlico still required authorization at the highest level. Mrs. Thatcher would have to give her personal stamp of approval for the escape plan. But the Prime Minister was in Scotland with the Queen.
Gordievsky made his preparations, appearing to do the sorts of things a man who was about to escape would not do. Attention to detail helped keep the dread at bay. He was now on a mission, no longer mere quarry, but a professional again. His fate was now back in his own hands. Much of Thursday was spent with his younger sister, Marina, and her family, in their Moscow apartment. A sweet and unquestioning soul, Marina would have been utterly horrified to learn that her only surviving brother was a spy. He also visited his widowed mother. Olga was now 78 and frail. Throughout his childhood, she had represented a spirit of quiet resistance, in contrast to his father's timidity and conformity. Of all his family members, Gordievsky's widowed mother was the one most likely to understand his actions. She would never have denounced him, but like any mother, she would also have tried to dissuade him from the path he was about to take. He embraced her and said nothing, knowing that whether the escape succeeded or failed, he would probably never see her again. Once home, he called Marina to arrange another get-together early the following week. A false trail laid, maintaining the pretense that he would still be in Moscow beyond the weekend. The more arrangements and appointments he made for the future, the better his chances of diverting KGB attention from what he was about to do. It felt manipulative to be using his family and friends as diversions, but they would surely understand, even if they never forgave him. Then Gordievsky did something exceptionally foolhardy and very funny. He called Mikhail Lyubimov and confirmed that he was coming to stay at his dacha the following week. Lyubimov said he was looking forward to it. His new girlfriend, Tanya, would be there. They would meet Gordievsky at 11:13 on Monday at Zvenigorod station. Gordievsky switched the subject. "Have you read Mr. Harrington's Washing by Somerset Maugham?" This was one of the short stories in the Ashenden series. Lyubimov had introduced him to the works of Maugham a decade earlier, when both were in Denmark. Gordievsky knew that his friend owned the complete works. "It's very good. You should read it again," said Gordievsky. "It's in volume 4. Look it up and you'll see what I mean." After some more chat, they rang off. Gordievsky had just planted a coded farewell to Lyubimov and an unambiguous literary clue. "Mr. Harrington's Washing is the tale of a British spy who escapes from revolutionary Russia through Finland. In Maugham's story, set in 1917, the British secret agent Ashenden travels on the Trans-Siberian Express on a mission to Russia. During the journey, he shares a carriage with an American businessman, Mr. Harrington, endearingly loquacious but infuriatingly fastidious. As revolution engulfs the country, Ashenden urges Harrington to take the train north before the revolutionary forces close in, but the American refuses to leave without his clothing, which has not been returned by the hotel laundry. Harrington is shot dead in the street by the revolutionary mob, having just retrieved his washing. The story is about risk. Man has always found it easier to sacrifice his life than to learn the multiplication table and getting out in time. Ashenden takes the train and escapes through Finland." It was highly unlikely that the KGB's eavesdroppers were versed in early 20th century English literature, and even more improbable that they would be able to decipher the clue in less than 24 hours. But it was a hostage to fortune nonetheless. His rebellion had always been, in part, a cultural one, a defiance of the philistinism of Soviet Russia. Leaving an obscure hint from Western literature was his parting shot, a demonstration of his own cultural superiority. Whether or not he escaped, the KGB would comb through the transcripts of his telephone conversations afterward and realize they had been mocked. They would hate him all the more, but perhaps admire him, too. Her annual visit to stay with the Queen in Balmoral was one of the prime ministerial duties Margaret Thatcher liked least. The tradition by which prime ministers spend a few days every summer as a guest in the Royal Scottish Castle was, Thatcher declared, a tedious waste of time. The Queen did not have much time for Thatcher, either, mocking her middle-class accent as Royal Shakespeare received pronunciation from circa 1950. Rather than stay in the main castle, Thatcher was housed in a cabin on the grounds, where she spent her days with her red boxes of official paperwork and a lone secretary, as far as possible from the royal world of bagpipes, Wellingtons, and corgis. On Thursday, July 18th, Christopher Kirwin made an urgent appointment to see Thatcher's private secretary, Charles Powell, at 10 Downing Street. There, In a private meeting room, C explained that Operation Pimlico had been activated and now required the personal authorization of the Prime Minister. Charles Powell was Thatcher's most trusted advisor, privy to the innermost secrets of her government. One of the handful of officials who had been briefed on the Nocton case, he later described the escape attempt as the single most secret thing I ever heard about. Neither he nor Thatcher had been told the real name of the man she called Mr. Collins. Powell was sure she would give her approval, but the escape plan was far too sensitive for the telephone. She would have to give clearance in person, and only Powell could ask her. I couldn't tell anyone in Number 10 what I was doing. That afternoon, Powell left Downing Street without saying where he was going, caught a train to Heathrow, and boarded a flight, which he had booked himself, to Aberdeen. It was so secret I later had a problem getting my expenses reimbursed. There, he hired a rental car and headed west, in the pouring rain. Balmoral Castle, the royal family's summer residence since 1852, is a vast granite pile adorned with turrets, and set on 50,000 acres of Scottish moors. On a gloomy and damp Scottish evening, it was quite hard to find. The clock was running, and Powell was exhausted and anxious by the time he eventually drew up at the massive gates to the castle in his small rental car. The equerry in the gatehouse was on the telephone, conducting a high-level discussion on a matter of considerable royal concern. The Queen wanted to borrow the Queen Mother's videotape recorder in order to watch Dad's army. This was proving hard to arrange. Powell tried to interrupt the conversation, but was silenced with a cold look. Cold looks are taught at equerry school. For the next 20 minutes, while Powell tapped his foot and looked at his watch, the equerry continued to discuss the royal videotape recorder, its precise whereabouts, and the need to move it from one room in the castle to another. Finally, the problem was solved. Powell explained who he was and that he needed to see the Prime Minister urgently. After another long delay, he was ushered into the presence of the Queen's private secretary, Sir Philip Moore, later Baron Moore of Wolvercote, GCB, GCVO, CMG, QSO and PC, and Chief Keeper of the Queen's Secrets. Moore was a courtier of ingrained caution and immovable protocol. On retirement, he would become a permanent Lord-in-Waiting. He did not like to be hurried. "Why do you want to see Mrs. Thatcher?" he asked. "I can't tell you," said Powell. "It's secret." Moore's sense of propriety was piqued. "We can't have people wandering around the Balmoral estate without knowing why they are here." "Well, you're going to have to, because I need to see the Prime Minister. Now." "Why do you need to see her?" "I can't tell you that." "You have to tell me." "I don't." "Whatever you tell the Prime Minister, she will tell the Queen, and Her Majesty will tell me. So, please, tell me your business." "No. If the Prime Minister wishes to tell the Queen, and the Queen wishes to tell you, that is for them to decide. But I am not able to tell you." The royal courtier fumed. If you are a private secretary, there is nothing more galling than another private secretary being more private than you are. Powell got to his feet. "I am going to go and look for the Prime Minister." With the injured air of a man who has witnessed an intolerable display of bad manners, Moore summoned a footman who led Powell out a side door, into the damp garden, and down a path to what appeared to be a sort of garden shed. Margaret Thatcher was propped up in bed, surrounded by papers. "She was very surprised to see me." It took Powell just a few minutes to explain the situation, and an even shorter time for Thatcher to authorize Operation Pimlico. The unnamed spy had played a vital part in her premiership, at great personal risk. "We have to honor our promises to our agent," she said. Powell later commented, "She admired him hugely, even though it cut against some of her principles. She hated traitors. But he was different, in a different league. She had huge respect for those who stood up to the regime. Mr. Collins, whoever he was, had done the West a great service. And now that he was in danger, Britain must do everything in its power to save him, whatever the diplomatic repercussions." What Mrs. Thatcher did not know, and never discovered, was that she had authorized an operation that was already underway. Had she declined to approve the escape attempt, there was no way to inform Gordievsky that there would be no one waiting for him at the rendezvous. He would have been abandoned, Pimlico was unstoppable. Chapter 14. The Runner. Friday, July 19th, 10 a.m., British Embassy, Moscow. As the hour of departure approached, Roy Ascot's mounting excitement competed with a rising dread. He had spent much of the night praying. I was pretty certain that, however we prepared ourselves, only prayer would see us through the operation. MI6 had never attempted to smuggle anyone across the Russian border before. If Pimlico arrived at the rendezvous alone, it would be hard enough. But if, as expected, he brought his wife and two children, the chance of success was infinitesimal. I thought, this man will be shot. The plan could not work. We all knew how flimsy the whole thing was. We were fulfilling a promise, and we had to do it, even though we were walking into something that wasn't going to work. I put the chances at 20% or lower. A telegram arrived from Century House. The bosses in London detected signs of wobbliness on the part of the embassy management and had composed a message to stiffen the sinews. It read, "The Prime Minister has personally approved this operation and expressed her complete confidence in your ability to carry it out. We all here join in standing 100% behind you and are confident you will succeed." Ascot showed it to Cartledge to demonstrate the continuing top-level clearance in London. Then another potentially lethal snag emerged. In order to leave the Soviet Union by car, foreign diplomats needed formal permission and special license plates. The official garage doing the plating closed at midday on Fridays. G's Ford was replated without a hitch, but Ascot Saab was sent back with the message, "Sorry, we can't plate this because your wife hasn't got a driving license." Caroline's handbag, containing her Soviet license, had been stolen the month before, and to obtain a new one, she had sent in her British license to the consular authorities. This had not yet been returned and a new Soviet license issued. Diplomats were not permitted to drive alone. Without a co-driver with a valid Soviet license, Ascot could not get the official plates. Without these plates, they could not leave the Soviet Union. Pimlico was about to founder on a tiny but immovable rock of Russian bureaucracy. At 11 a.m., an hour before the traffic authority shut for the weekend, Ascot was still racking his brains for a solution when a package arrived from the Soviet Foreign Ministry containing Caroline's British license and a new Soviet one. We had an hour to get our car plated in time. I couldn't believe it, this incredible stroke of luck. But on second thought, Ascot wondered if the unexpected and timely return of the license really was serendipity, or part of the KGB setup. We had cleared the last obstacle to travel, but it all looked very pat. 11 a.m., Leninsky Prospect, Moscow. Gordievsky spent the morning cleaning the flat, from top to bottom. In a very short time, the KGB would tear it apart, rip up the floorboards, demolish his library page by page, and dismantle every stick of furniture. But some odd pride made him determine that his home should look shipshape when they arrived to destroy it. He did the washing up, arranged the crockery, washed his clothes in the sink, and hung them out to dry. On the counter, he left money for Layla, 220 rubles, enough to cover household expenses for a few days. It was a small gesture, but of what? His continuing care? Apology? Regret? The money would probably never reach her. The KGB would surely confiscate or steal it. Yet, like the meticulous cleaning of the flat, he was sending a message that said more about him, perhaps, than he realized. Gordievsky wanted to be thought of as a good man. He wanted the KGB, which he had deceived so comprehensively, to respect him. He left no note of self-justification, no explanation for having betrayed the Soviet Union. If they caught him, the KGB would extract all that, and this time with nothing so gentle as a truth drug. He left a spotless flat and a lot of clean laundry. Like Mr. Harrington, he would not flee without doing his washing. Then Gordievsky prepared to throw off the KGB surveillance squad for a fourth and final time. The timing was crucial. If he left the flat and evaded his watchers too early, They might finally spot what was afoot and raise the alarm. But if he left it too late, he might not be able to complete his dry cleaning, and would reach the railway station with the KGB still on his tail. He did his packing, meager enough, in an ordinary plastic bag. A light jacket, his Danish leather cap, sedatives, and a small Soviet-printed road atlas that covered the Finnish border region, doubtless inaccurate, since the area was militarily sensitive. He forgot to pack the snuff. 11 a.m., Valimaa Motel, Finland. The Finnish end of Operation Pimlico was running according to schedule. The team assembled at a small motel, about 10 miles from the border. Veronica Price and Simon Brown, traveling under false passports, had arrived in Helsinki the previous evening and spent the night in an airport hotel. Martin Shawford, the young MI6 officer in charge of coordinating matters in Finland, was already waiting when they drew up in the motel parking lot, followed a few minutes later by the two Danish PET officers, Eriksson and Larsen. Coincidentally, the cars had all been booked through the same rental company at the airport, and to Shawford's horror, three identical cars were now parked in the lot. Three bright red, brand new Volvos with sequential license plates. We looked like a convention. It could hardly have been more conspicuous. At least one car would have to be changed before the next day. The rendezvous point on the Finnish side of the border had been selected when Veronica Price first formulated the plan. 5 miles northwest of the border crossing, a forestry track turned off to the right and led into the woods. About a mile along it, on the left, was a small clearing, where the logging trucks turned, surrounded by trees and invisible from the main road. The spot was close enough to the frontier to ensure Oleg and his family would not remain cramped in the car trunks a moment longer than necessary, but far enough away to be well clear of the border security zone. The combined MI6 PET team thoroughly reconnoitred the area around the rendezvous point. The Finnish pine forest stretched away unbroken on every side. There were no houses in sight. Here they would meet the getaway team, swiftly move the escapees from the MI6 cars into the Finnish rental cars, and then split up into two groups. The Finnish team would reassemble at a second rendezvous point in the woods about 10 miles farther on, where they could check the escapees' health, change their clothing, and speak freely without fear of being overheard through the bug diplomatic cars. Meanwhile, the Moscow team would take the road toward Helsinki and wait at the first petrol station. The escape team would begin the long journey north to the Finnish-Norwegian border. Leila and one child would travel in the Danes' car, Gordievsky and the other girl with Brown and Price. Shawford would rejoin the MI6 Moscow team at the petrol station, debrief Ascot and G, and make an important call from the public telephone kiosk in the forecourt. The call would be automatically routed through to the Sov block controller, waiting with the P5 team in Century House. The petrol station telephone might be monitored by the KGB or Finnish intelligence, so the outcome of Pimlico would have to be reported in veiled language. If Gordievsky and his family were out and safe, Shawford would say that his fishing holiday had been successful. If, however, the escape had failed, he would report that he had caught nothing. Having thoroughly checked the rendezvous area, the team drove back to Helsinki, swapped one of their fleet of bright red Volvos for another model, and dispersed to separate hotels. 12 p.m., Kutuzovsky Prospect, Moscow. In the diplomatic flats, Caroline Ascot and Rachel G. did the packing. They could take no personal clothing, since all the space in the trunks was needed to accommodate Pimlico and his family. Instead, they assembled a number of empty travel bags that looked realistically bulky when stuffed with cushions, but could be folded flat when emptied. The escape kit, first assembled 7 years earlier, was retrieved from the British Embassy safe. Water bottles and children's plastic sippy cups, which would be easier for the girls to drink from in the cramped trunks. 2 large empty bottles to urinate into, and 4 space blankets, made of heat-reflective, thin plastic sheeting, of the sort used to reduce heat loss in cases of hypothermia or exertion. Heat sensors and infrared cameras at the Soviet border were believed to be capable of picking up a concealed body, but no one in MI6 was sure how the technology worked, or whether it really existed. The escapees would have to strip to their underwear before pulling the blankets over themselves. It would be hot inside the trunks, and the lower their body temperatures, the less the likelihood of attracting the sniffer dogs and heat sensors. Caroline